morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Christopher Hammond, I'm arguing on behalf of all petitioners. The petitions for review in this case challenge EPA's decision to issue several certificates of conformity. As the name suggests, a certificate of conformity is lawful only if the engines being certified actually conform to existing emission standards. The engines at issue here indisputably do not conform to the NOx standard, and so therefore, barring some independent and valid basis for the certificates, they would need to be vacated as contrary to law. The only independent basis EPA identified was their interim final rule. But because this court and Mack Trucks vacated the interim final rule, there is no existing independent authority, neither then nor now. That's a straightforward application on the merits of this court's decision in National Fuel Gas and the Supreme Court's decision in Reynoldsville Casket. Both of those cases stand for a common sense proposition that where an Article III court has issued a ruling on the merits, that ruling continues to apply as if it had always been the law. The purpose of those decisions is not that a court, as this court said in National Fuel Gas, discovers what the law is going forward. It's that it discerns what the law has always been. If the basis for those certificates has always been unlawful, the certificates necessarily have always been unlawful. And that is why there is very little merits discussion and defense in EPA's brief. Instead, their principal defense on appeal is that we don't have standing or that this case is moot. Their claim of injury in fact, though, I think has been squarely rejected by this court's decision, not just in Mack Trucks, which presented the same question, but by this court's decision in Shirley v. Sebelius, which of course confirms that there's the doctrine of competitive standing. Here, of course, there's no question that these are competitors. There's no question that EPA has relaxed a regulatory requirement that has allowed Navistar, allegedly at least, to introduce into commerce.
What about redressability?
So redressability, just to be clear, of course, standing is a snapshot at the time the petition is filed. When the petition was filed, there's no question that Navistar was still producing engines, and a decision vacating those certificates would have redressed the injury, no question. So what we're really talking about is a question of mootness at this point. Now that this is model year 2013, what's the effect of it? But of course, what this court, what the Supreme Court said in Knox is that a case is moot only if it's impossible to craft any effectual relief whatsoever to the prevailing party. Here, there are at least two types of effectual relief that remain. One is an enforcement action brought by EPA, and another is a citizen suit brought by these particular...
So you don't disagree that but for those secondary routes, the case would be moot?
I think that's right, although I think there's one open question. I will say this. Those certificates allow Navistar to manufacture engines all the way through 2012. They could have produced engines all the way up to December 31st, 2012. It's still possible, we don't know because there's no discovery in a case like this, that they could still have engines stockpiled that they could be selling into commerce. So an order vacating those certificates would actually make it unlawful at this point going forward. We just don't know that. So I think, Judge Srinivasan, it's still even theoretically possible that a vacatur could have some extant impact. But looking at those two bases, the civil suit, the citizen suit, and the enforcement proceeding, both are legitimate bases. And this court's decision in Bennett versus Donovan makes that same point. There's no reason why the relief has to flow inherently and immediately from this court's decree. This court, in a number of occasions, Bennett just being the most recent, understands that remedies can flow downstream in a subsequent proceeding. In that case, for example, this court recognized that a decree, a declaratory judgment, striking down HUD's regulation as unlawful would have given those plaintiffs no immediate relief. After all, the immediate injury that threatened them was foreclosure by private lenders. But this court hypothesized that HUD could voluntarily accept the mortgage assignment. HUD could then voluntarily pay off those mortgages. Then HUD could voluntarily, in subsequent actions, elect not to foreclose on those plaintiffs. Those are all downstream actions, not even in a separate civil proceeding, and all discretionary on HUD's behalf. And yet what this court said, the rule it articulated, is the one that fits comfortably here, that where the agency has caused the harm and where the agency is the actor capable of providing remedy, that is, quote, sufficient to establish that relief is likely, end quote.
Do you have in mind a parallel situation here? Because in Bennett, I think part of what the court was getting at is that HUD itself had it within its power to render relief effectively. Here, I take it what you have in mind is not something that the EPA in and of itself could do. It's an action that would be either brought by EPA or by you. then it would be incumbent upon a court to impose civil penalties.
Well, not necessarily, because EPA does have the discretion to impose civil penalties outside of bringing a court action. Section 7524C of the Clean Air Act, or Title 42, gives them the right to pursue civil penalties through an administrative action. Now, fees are capped there at only $200,000 and adjusted for inflation about $295,000. But, of course, redressability, the question is, can any redress come at all? So I think your hypothetical, Judge Srinivasan, is met by 7524C2 right there. Now, of course, 7524B is where you bring a civil action and there would be a challenge.
That's what I thought you had focused on in your submission.
Well, no, I think we've raised eight civil penalties writ large. Whether it's under B or C, both avenues apply. And so the immediate response to the Bennett question and having it within the authority of the government, that's clearly met, I think, in this particular case. But I also don't think that there's any requirement in this court's precedent, certainly, that it has to be that the agency has that inherent power. In fact, there are other cases that this court has decided where it's recognized that a decision from invalidating one agency action could very well have implications downstream on either state agencies and their decision to approve a project or on other federal agencies and their decision to approve projects. One of which is a National Parks Conservation Association versus Manson, Town of Barnstable versus FAA. Both of those are cases where this court has recognized that vacating non-binding agency actions could have effect downstream even with state agencies and others. Here, of course, it's not nearly as tenuous. EPA, as Bennett says, is the actor that's caused the injury, and EPA is the actor that can remedy the injury. It can do so by bringing that action. But, of course, there's also the civil citizen suit provision that the petitioners can themselves bring. That gives a party, any person, the right to sue any person for a violation of an emission standard or limitation.
Now, can I ask an antecedent question, which is it clear that there, in fact, was a violation? Because what I have in mind is the following, that, and it appears that both parties are assuming that there was, if, in fact, the certificates are vacated. But in point of fact, when Navistar manufactured its engines, they did have a certificate. So the certificates are then, by hypothesis, vacated after the fact.
Right.
In some sense, there's something that seems a bit of a mismatch to say that they violated the law by not having a certificate when, at the time they manufactured the engines, in fact, a certificate existed.
Well, I don't think so for the precisely same rule that if this court were to vacate the certificates, the rule of National Fuel Gas, the rule of Reynoldsville Casket, is that the certificates never existed in the first place. And so as you look ahead to an enforcement proceeding, the question at that point is, were these engines introduced into commerce at a time when there was a valid certificate?
So EPA had just mistakenly issued a certificate. They mistakenly issued a certificate to Company A that was intended for Company B.
Right.
And A then acts in reliance on the issuance of a certificate to it. And then it turns out that the certificate actually was intended for Company B, and so it's withdrawn, and EPA makes the correction that A actually has violated the law.
Yes, they have. But there's an important distinction here between whether there's a violation and what the appropriate remedy is. The Clean Air Act itself and the enforcement proceedings involving civil penalties recognizes a number of mitigating circumstances. In fact, 7524B and C, both the judicial review provision and the purely administrative one, asks the decision maker to focus on, for example, the competitive advantage the violator reaped, but also other factors that justice may require. And so those are all situations that can be dealt with in the remedial phase. And perhaps that means the remedy is zero, or perhaps it means it's the maximum of $37,000. The point is, and this is what the Supreme Court emphasized in Reynoldsville Casket, remedy is a separate question. The question of violation writ large is one that doesn't take account of concerns about reliance. And that's all that EPA and Navistar here have pleaded, bare reliance. That was rejected in National Fuel Gas by this court. That was rejected by the Supreme Court in Reynoldsville Casket. And I do think, Judge Srinivasan, that as the case comes before this court, it's certainly under a Chenery standard, not an argument that EPA itself has made in this court, which then gets us right back to the merits of this case. There is redressability because EPA can provide it, and there's redressability for the reasons that the petitioners can bring a citizen suit. They've also suggested that there's some problem with the fact that these are civil penalties that go to the Department of the Treasury as opposed to the petitioners themselves. But that's not a problem either. The NCPs themselves, which Congress designed to remediate the competitive disadvantage that happens when you have a non-compliant manufacturer enter the marketplace, are penalties paid to the Treasury. So a civil penalty under the rubric of 7524 that goes to the Treasury, and a penalty called a nonconformance penalty that goes to the Treasury that's also designed to wipe out those competitive disadvantages, have the exact same effect. And if these petitioners would have standing, as they surely would, to come into court and say, we don't disagree that NCPs were proper, we just think the amount was wrong, and the remedy being, okay, increase the amount, it doesn't matter that the petitioners aren't going to get that extra amount. They never were going to get those amounts in the first place.
But is the amount of the civil money penalty under the statute pegged to the degree of competitive injury?
It is. Well, it's certainly one of the factors. And if you look at 7524B, when civil penalties are brought in court, and 7524C2, where the agency itself has the authority to bring it in its own right, one of the various factors is the degree of competitive advantage and gain that the violator has reaped.
The statute actually says that.
It does, in fact, say that, which is almost, in large measure, the same standard that Congress itself laid out for competitive advantages for NCPs themselves at 7525G3E. The point is that both of them are penalties. One is called a civil penalty, and one is called a nonconformance penalty. But both are designed to do the exact same thing, remediate the competitive disadvantages to those compliant manufacturers. And in that sense, it's no different than you have in perhaps international trade. There are two ways to remedy trade violations. You can either have a direct subsidy that pays the domestic industry something, or you can have a tariff that acts as an economic anchor on those who are not compliant with the law. In either case, the point is to help level the playing field. Here, these penalties are designed to do precisely the same thing. That then leaves basically mootness, standing, irreversibility satisfied, and the merits at that point becomes a simple application, again, as I said at the outset, of National Fuel Gas.
Before you go to the merits, can I just ask you, for purposes of mootness and irreversibility, and I think I agree with you, they're interrelated here. You represent a client in this industry. What would you have counseled Navistar to have done in this context if you were in that situation when you have a company that has a certificate to manufacture engines?
Well, let's be clear. If our counseling Navistar, first of all, would have said perhaps exercise the diligence earlier in making sure those certificates, you wouldn't need them in the first place. But beyond that, I think parties have to accept the risks of regulatory action. This is a situation in which Navistar took these certificates knowing that the basis for them, the IFR, was under challenge. They knew that this court had already granted expedited consideration, which under this court's internal operating procedures shows that there's a substantial question. It knew that there was a ongoing challenge, and it understood, it should have, based on National Fuel Gas and Reynoldsville Casket, that the effect of a vacatur would have a retroactive vacatur effect on those certificates. So what I would have said is, perhaps it's in your interest to use them, perhaps you should use some of your other credits. There are other options out there. But it doesn't just because you've put yourself into that bind doesn't mean the law has to bail you out. And that's certainly one of the, I think, important lessons of this court's decision in Mack Trucks in the first instance.
What's another option other than the use of the credits? And do we know that they had those credits?
Well, they've suggested that they had some credits. It's an open question how many credits they have because that's a confidential business information. And so we have been in the dark about that. They had any number of different options. They could have also gone out on the market, as they ultimately did, and purchase engines from other manufacturers to put in their trucks. After this court's decision in Mack Trucks, for example, they went out and purchased engines from Cummins, another petitioner actually in Mack Trucks, and have used those Cummins engines to help provide the trucks that they are selling on the market. So it's not as if they were foreclosed or were going to have to leave the market but for this. And again, that sort of is putting the cart before the horse. They could have made these decisions many years earlier. They find themselves in that bind, and that's not the problem of the petitioners in this industry. They're the petitioners here are the ones battling this unfair competition situation. If there are no further questions, I'll preserve the balance of my time.
Judge Griffith.
Yeah, I need to have a question. Does it matter whether EPA is unlikely to undertake an enforcement action against Navistar? I mean, you're saying there are two moves of redress here, the citizen suit and EPA enforcement action. What are we supposed to look at the likelihood of EPA moving such an action?
No, and I think this court's decision in Bennett speaks to that. What Bennett said and the rule it articulated there said nothing about the probability of agency action. In fact, this court recognized that could very well be that the agency would end up doing nothing in that case. The rule was a more categorical one, that where the agency has is the actor that's caused the harm and where the agency is the actor that can provide relief, that arrangement, quote, is sufficient to establish that relief is likely, end quote. The basic point is here. EPA caused the harm, and EPA can provide a remedy. Whether it is going to, whether it's likely to, that is not the question. The question is that it can. That's enough to establish that it's likely.
And are you aware of any cases, any citizen suits that have challenged the validity of nonconformity certificates?
No, in large part, it's never a close question whether these certificates of conformity are valid. It's a pretty easy question. You know what the standards of emissions are, and no one really challenges and disputes what those exist. It's only in this unique type of situation where EPA has deliberately granted a certificate to engines that violate these emission standards and have done so on the basis of an IFR that was at that time purported to be valid. So this is a unique situation, and that's why this would be an unprecedented case, but one that I think fits comfortably in the broad remedial scheme of the any person may sue any violator of the Clean Air Act of the citizen suit provision.
I'm curious, why did you bring separate challenges to the IFR and to the certificates? If they are so inextricably intertwined, why pursue them in two separate actions?
Largely by timing, accident of timing. The IFR issued at one point, the certificates issued down the road. We filed our challenge to the certificates at a time when this court was almost already about to hear the argument in the IFR challenge, which, keep in mind, was granted on an expedited basis. We filed our opening brief in about 10 days and our reply in 3 or 4 days, I believe. So that proceeded on a very quick basis. We would have, I think, ideally been able to consolidate those appeals, but we can't control the timing that EPA issues those certificates.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Walter?
Good morning. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Michelle Walter with the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States Environmental Protection Agency. With me at council table, I have Michael Horowitz from EPA's Office of General Counsel, and also Mr. Kerry Perlman, who is Navistar's counsel. First of all, Judge Griffith, can you hear me all right?
I can.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure my voice can kind of fade in and out. There are several questions that you both raised that I would like to address, including the stockpiling and credit issue, the Bennett case, and the National Fuel Gas Supply case, as well as the A versus B example that you gave, Judge. But before I do that, I would like to just take a step back and look at the timeline of events as they occurred in this case so that we can better understand why we're in this situation of trying to struggle with this very difficult, I think, remedy issue that at least I haven't seen this type of issue, this discrete issue, present itself in cases before. So just backing up a little bit, petitioners filed their petition for review of the first certificate that EPA issued in February of last year, and then filed the petition for review of the subsequent certificates in April of last year. So we're talking well over a year and a half since the petitions for review were filed in this case. And it's also been well over a year since the court in the Mack Trucks case issued its decision and then also its subsequent mandate. Now, that time is important because at no point during that time did petitioners ask for a stay or did they ask for expedited briefing, which they did ask for expedited briefing in the Mack Trucks case. And now we're a year and a half past when the petitions were filed and over a year past the Mack Trucks decision.
When did we hold it in abeyance, though?
Excuse me?
Wasn't this the case that was held in abeyance?
Yes, in fact, petitioners asked, and EPA consented, of course, to hold this in abeyance pending the Mack Trucks decision.
Okay.
The point being that if they were concerned about the certificates that could be used during the pendency of the Mack Trucks case, that they had other remedies available to them to try to stave that off. And now we're 9 months past when the certificates were last used at the end of last year. December 31st. And now petitioners, when you go back and essentially unring a bell that they had an opportunity to prevent over a year ago. Now, again, just addressing some of the questions that the court raised to try to get out this remedy issue a little bit further.
I just have one preliminary question.
Sure.
Is the said that the certificates stopped being used on December 31st, but council raised the possibility that there's certificates that could still be used if there are engines, I guess, basically in inventory.
Let me clarify that, Judge. The 2012 certificates are only for engines that were manufactured in 2012. Based on my conversations with Mr. Perlman, Navistar's counsel, my understanding is that although they can't give the court a guarantee that there isn't an engine somewhere in a warehouse that hasn't been introduced into commerce, that essentially every engine that would have been used under the 2012 certificates is out into commerce, and we can no longer get those back. So any engine that may be stockpiled, I think is the term was used, my understanding is that would be engines that were manufactured, and these engines are manufactured for specific orders. They're not just kind of mass manufactured like tennis shoes for somebody to come purchase. They're for specific orders. And so if Navistar had manufactured a specific engine, it may have been returned because it didn't meet some particular requirement or it wasn't quite satisfactory. So those might be the types of engines that we're talking about. But if we are talking about any of those, they are very few. They're certainly not even 100. They're not numbers that I have, but that's the best understanding I have concerning the stockpiling issue. And also related to that is the credit issue that you brought up. Navistar did have credits that it could have used instead of using NCP certificates. So the questions of injury are entirely speculative because we just don't know if Navistar could have introduced those same engines using the credits that it had and that it continued to have throughout 2012. Now, one important thing I would like to mention is that in the declaration that petitioners submitted with their reply brief to demonstrate standing, there's an important sentence in the Gressler Declaration that actually goes to, I think, the redressability issue, which is in the last paragraph of the Gressler Declaration, paragraph 9, and the very last sentence says, losses associated with such lost market share are not recoverable. And the reason that I think that that sentence is important is because this court has made very clear in the Jaramillo case, this court has made very clear that for purposes of standing, that the redressability has to be specifically to that petitioner for their relief. And in that case, it was a petition for review of an FCC license authorizing a particular radio station. And the petitioners actually claimed, as the petitioners here do, that they had competitor standing, as well as what they call listener standing. And the court said that competitor injury was only addressed in a footnote, but even given that, it was not going to be remediable past injury, which is the situation we have here. And we cite this case in our brief, but essentially the court was saying that past injury is not enough for a petitioner who does not seek compensation for that injury. And that's what we're talking about here and why the redressability question is so key, is that the citizen suit and the enforcement avenues that petitioner discussed are not avenues that, even if they were pursued, and I'll get to that in a second, are not avenues that would put any money back in petitioner's pocket to remedy that past lost market share. And that, to the extent they have an injury that the court will consider in the affidavits, that cannot be redressed.
But I think their argument, I take it, is that true enough, the money doesn't flow to them, but the money at least flows out of Navistar. And if it's true that the calculation of the civil money penalty is pegged to competitive injury, then I guess the idea is that the degree of competitive injury, the degree of ill-gotten competitive gain that Navistar experienced as a consequence of operating without a valid certificate would be disgorged by Navistar. And so you would have, in effect, a redress of the competitive injury by virtue of the fact that Navistar has to relinquish their ill-gotten gain. That's the theory, I think.
Well, I understand that's the theory, and two issues I have with that. First of all, this is, again, you can't go back and unring the bell of lost market share. Petitioners can't go back and get the customers that bought the Navistar engines, and that's really their injury. So to say now that over a year later, just taking some money out of Navistar's general pot of money is going to somehow compensate them for that very specific market share loss is not the standard that this court requires. So I understand the theory,
from your perspective, once we know that money can't flow to petitioners, the case is over.
Under this court's case law, that past injury, if it cannot be redressed specific to the petitioner, then yes. Also, I did want to discuss the Bennett case that petitioners mentioned, and that was the case concerning the HUD foreclosure. The key distinction between that case and this case is that there actually was no mention in the Bennett case of the likelihood of HUD's subsequent foreclosure. No mention of it at all, including whether HUD itself thought that that foreclosure was likely. Here we have a statement on the record from EPA in our brief that enforcement action, whether it be a civil action or an administrative action, is highly unlikely. And I think that distinguishes this case from the Bennett case because it removes it from having the injury that this court has required to be likely for standing purposes. Also, the National Fuel Gas case is...
I think counsel made the point. I think the opinion of Bennett seems to presuppose that HUD might well have not undertaken the actions that would have been necessary in order to grant relief. So why is that different if you're relying on the fact that you have actually made the assertion in your brief that it's highly unlikely?
Yes, because even if the court makes that assumption there again, HUD said nothing, at least from the facts of the case as I read them, HUD said nothing about the likelihood of their enforcement actions. Even if the court assumed that HUD wasn't going to take that action, here we have an even better situation that EPA has actually said that enforcement action is highly unlikely. The National Fuel Gas case from the D.C. Circuit goes through the litany of Supreme Court cases that have discussed this kind of redressability versus remedy issue. And the important takeaway actually from that case is its discussion of the Reynoldsville Casket versus Hyde case. And in that Hyde case, the court did recognize that there were essentially four specific circumstances where even if a decision is applied retroactively, that there may be different alternatives to remedies or remedies that a situation where a remedy would not be available. And at least two of those could be applicable here, the first of which is that there is a previously existing independent legal basis for denying relief. And here that independent legal basis was EPA's independent authority to issue the certificates that it did, along with the regulatory process that EPA has in place for revoking or retroactively voiding those certificates. Also, the Hyde case recognized a situation where there could be a well-established legal rule or that would reflect both reliance and interest and other significant policy justifications. And again, here, I think we have well-established rules, particularly in the context of licenses, which is what these certificates are, that if you're going to retroactively take a license away from somebody, there is a process for doing that, both under EPA's regulations and under the APA.
But isn't there a difference between retroactively revoking a license and just vacating a license that was issued? And it just doesn't seem to me right to say that the procedures for revoking a license that has been issued that EPA has for good and sufficient reasons inform the conditions under which the license would be vacated. The predicate for vacating it is just different from the predicate for revoking.
If I understand the question correctly, are you essentially asking the difference between EPA's process versus a court decision that
right.
would vacate the certificates?
I think that what the point you're making is that EPA has in place a series of procedures, and this is already made brief, a series of procedures under which a license would be revoked. And there's something wrong about supposing that we could vacate a license without taking stock of those procedures that EPA has in place. And it just seems to me that the response to that is that they're just two different worlds.
It's the APA as well. I mean, even setting aside EPA's regulations, this is an APA case. And the petitioners brought this case claiming that the certificates were arbitrary and capricious under the APA, which they should be judged then on the record that was before EPA at that time. But in addition, the APA procedures for licenses would also apply, which is something that the court should be mindful of because, again, this court has recognized that things like certificates or licenses are entitled to a process before they are taken away from the certificate or licensee. So even setting aside EPA's regulatory process, we still have the APA to contend with. And petitioners raise a point in their reply brief that the APA is inapplicable because the certificates expired by their own terms at the end of 2012. But that's not what's contemplated by the APA or the case law concerning that. That expiration of certificates or licenses on their own refers to if there's been a violation of some type of condition in the license and the license is no longer applicable, then those APA due process procedures don't apply. But that's not the case that we had here. I did want to just quickly address your A versus B example in the remaining time that I have. And the distinction here, and I think also maybe getting to your last question, Your Honor, is that there is a difference between, and I might get the terminology wrong, so forgive me, between revoking certificates prospectively and voiding them retroactively. And in your A versus B example, if I recall the facts correctly, it was a permit was incorrectly issued to one party and should have been issued to another party. In that situation, EPA would take the approach of prospectively revoking the certificates because, as we have here, we have a company who would have relied on that in good faith, and EPA, I think as a general matter, would not want to then punish a company for relying on that type of situation.
Would you agree that in that situation, though, that the company that manufactured an engine with a permit that it should have never gotten violated the law, so that the civil money penalty provision in theory could apply, even if as a matter of discretion you wouldn't?
I don't think that's something that we can acknowledge because, again, those are facts that EPA would need to look at in their enforcement discretion and decide if they thought that there had been a violation of the law. Judge Griffith, if you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
We would just ask then that the petitions either be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds or denied in their entirety. Thank you very much.
How much time do you have? Oh, how about 2 minutes?
Let me start first with Judge Srinivasan's question. This is a case challenging the issuance of these certificates, not asking EPA to revoke them. That's an important distinction. We filed a timely challenge to the issuance of these licenses. And like any agency action, the question is, not only was this arbitrary and capricious, but was it contrary to law? If it's contrary to law, the act of issuance needs to be vacated. This is not a coming to the scene years later and saying you should revoke this, which would trigger a lot of those remedial schemes. This was a timely challenge. That's why none of those regulations involving revocations apply. National Fuel Gas, my friend on the other side, says that National Fuel Gas has a number of exceptions that they would now like to claim in oral argument. The problem is that none of them apply. There is no independent basis that they can identify. These certificates, the only basis that were identified, and you can see that at page 1, 8, and 14 of the joint appendix with the accompanying letter, was the IFR. The IFR is now vacated. There's no independent basis. They also claim that there can be a well-established rule that Reynoldsville Casket recognized. The well-established rule that Reynoldsville Casket acknowledged was rules like qualified immunity. There's no case for qualified immunity here. National Fuel Gas applies. On Bennett versus Donovan, they've claimed that they said they will not do this action. Well, that's a statement from agency counsel. It's not the agency's own views. We don't know what the agency's views are. And it was just as unlikely or hypothetical in Bennett itself. And for whatever it's worth, and I don't know if it's worth that much, but Bennett did file, the HUD filed a petition for rehearing and said on page 2 of their petition, we are absolutely never going to do this, but this court never even called for a response in that. As far as the notion of civil penalties, my friend relies on the Jaramillo case. What Jaramillo says is that there has to be compensation or either damages or similar compensation. Well, the civil penalties here would be a similar type of compensation. In fact, it would be the exact same type of compensation that Congress designed for manufacturers in this situation. The penalty that Congress fashioned for NCPs when there is a non-compliant manufacturer was not a transfer of dollars from that manufacturer to its competitors, but money to the Treasury. And Congress understood that would remedy those harms. That's perfectly in keeping with general principles of remedying harms abroad. And then finally, counsel complains about the timing of this litigation. We actually agreed with the EPA to hold these in abeyance because we frankly thought that resolution of the Matt Drucks decision and the IFR was necessarily going to resolve this. We had little inkling that EPA would actually come to court and argue that under National Fuel Gas, under Reynoldsville Casket, a decision vacating the IFR wasn't going to, of course, have an effect here. That was, in fact, the whole predicate understanding for why these cases were held in abeyance. Otherwise, it was a whole waste of time for us ever to hold them in abeyance in the first place. If there are no further questions, thank you.
All right, Judge Griffith?
No, I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you very much.